Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look today at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk back with us. She's a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. We'll be talking about common eye problems in cats and dogs, why cats like catnip, and of course, we'll be answering your pet care questions. So I hope you'll join in today. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can also post questions and pet photos on our Facebook page. We always love to see those photos, so please do that as well. And Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
Nice to be here, Larry.
Well, let's talk about eye conditions. What are some of the common ones in cats and dogs that you see?
Well, a lot of times I get phone calls from people regarding, is this an emergency? Should I be seen right away? And I think anytime it involves vision or the eye, if you're concerned, get your pet to the veterinarian. But some of the big things that owners should be on the lookout for would be eye discharge. I'm not talking about the little white morning sleepers that sometimes will turn kind of a rusty brown color because it oxidizes, but if there's any yellow or green discharge from the eye, that could indicate that there's an infection going on, or sometimes we'll see it associated with something that one of my dogs has, something called dry eye, where they don't make enough tears to be able to keep the eye flushed. And what you'd see with that, besides the discharge, is the cornea would look kind of, instead of nice and shiny, that's the structure that if you wear contact lenses is going to sit on top of. Pets have that same clear structure in front of their eye. If that starts to look cloudy or kind of dull in appearance, good time to be saying, we better get them into the veterinarian. Obviously, rubbing at the eye, squinting would be a problem too. And the reason why I brought this up is I had an owner that had their dog was squinting after getting into a confrontation with their cat. And they thought, well, maybe the dog got its eye scratched. And so they brought it right in on emergency. It was worse than that. When I finally was able to get the eyelids pried apart after putting in some topical anesthetic to numb the eye, there was the cat's claw penetrated through the cornea, and the husk had pulled off, and the dog was just squinting, holding this thing in place. So it was a corneal puncture and obviously a very bad emergency. You know, anytime that we start seeing things like there's a little gland that sits in the corner of the eye called the third eyelid, that's called the gland of the third eyelid, sometimes those will prolapse. And although it's not really an emergency, it does look horrible. They get this big red kind of circular thing in the corner of their eye. In fact, it's given the nickname cherry eye. Sometimes if we can get those massaged and replaced quickly, massaged back into place, it may stay in place. If not, then you may be looking at having some surgery done to be able to have that thing tack back down again. Other things that we would be looking for would be, I mentioned, you know, kind of that the cornea looking kind of dull. But if you start seeing any opacities, like whitish areas on the surface of the cornea, that could indicate that there's an ulcer or something like that going on. And we had a friend of mine, they had a pet sitter while they were on vacation, and the dog's eye started to water and was squinting, and they didn't take it in, and it turned out that the dog had a corneal ulcer that ruptured, but the dog's eye is going to be okay. Had to have some emergency surgery done. Obviously, vision loss, which is sometimes hard to see. I'm always surprised at how many people don't realize that their pet is blind. But sometimes when it happens so acutely, the pet's really disoriented and have bumping into things. We will see this mainly in cats rather than dogs, but where they end up with retinal detachment due to hypertension. Cats and dogs aren't complaining about headaches. We don't always check their blood pressure when we have them in the vet clinic because sometimes they're nervous and we get artificial readings. But that's one of the leading causes of retinal detachment, especially in cats when they're hypertensive. Anything that causes the eye to swell, whether it's the eyelids that are swelling or the eyeball itself that's swelling or something behind the eye that's pushing the eye out. If you look at your pet and you say, one eye just looks like it's a little bit more forward than the other, again, that would be something to say, we better get them in, because that could be a sign of glaucoma, a tumor, something that really needs to be seen. And lastly, I actually talked to the ophthalmologist before I left, and I said, these are the things I want to talk about. And they said one thing that they would be also saying is any sudden change in color of the eye, meaning that your dog's normal eye, all of a sudden it looks red. And I'm not talking, I mean, yes, if they, we've got the whites of the eye looking red or redness around the eye, but the color of the eye itself, that may mean that we've got some intraocular hemorrhage or inflammation that really needs to be seen right away. And so lots of things that we want to be watching for. And so every day, look into those nice dark brown or blue eyes or whatever color your pets have. And if you see any differences, any changes, anything that makes you worried, better safe than sorry, because we don't want to mess with vision.
What the cat's vision is kind of interesting to me. They when Coco, my one of my cats, eats its wet food, it sort of mixes, pushes it around, and then it doesn't eat the pieces that are kind of straight
off
out.
To the side. Yeah, and I don't know why they do that. I mean, cats are predators, and so their vision is more being able to look like kind of like straight ahead rather than being prey, where they want to be able to see everything around them. And so it may have something to do with it just being pushed aside. It may just come down to he likes the gravy and he doesn't like the solid bits, you know, or it starts to get, you know, kind of a little stale. So why do I want to eat it? But yeah, cats, I mean, people always think that cats can see in the dark. They can't. I mean, if it's total darkness, they're not going to be able to see. They see better with low light than obviously we do. That's why they can be nocturnal predators, but they do still need some light to be able to see.
Well, I have to admit that I take a spoon after the initial eating and I scrape it all back together in a pile, and then he eats that.
Okay. Well, there you go. Maybe he just is waiting for that kind of waiter service that you're providing him. Yeah.
Boy. Well, catnip is another thing I wanted to mention before we go to the phones here. Most cats have a reaction to catnip, even large cats like lions, I'm told.
Yeah, tigers know, which is really interesting. A lot of tigers don't respond, but when we look at our domestic cats, baby cats tend to not be responders, but as they get a little bit older, in the first, like, maybe, you know, 4, 5, 6 months of age, you'll start to see them reacting to it. But in general, only about 70% of cats respond to catnip. So if you're going out and buying catnip toys and your cat's just like, I don't care about it, it may be in that 30% that it's just not going to respond. But the kind of the classic signs that we'll see will be drooling, rolling. Sometimes they'll start kicking their back feet out. They get this kind of glazed look on their face, and they're obviously enjoying themselves. And some of the research that's been done often shows that they react like a tomcat would to a female cat in heat, you know, where they the same kind of reaction. But what about those cats that are non-responders? There was a study that was done that was looking at some of the other plants that people may have in their yard or garden, or maybe even want to cultivate themselves, that would be safe for use around cats. You always want to make sure that any plants you bring into your house are safe. And they found that some of these, there's one that's called silver vine that you can actually get it in a ground compound, and then valerian root and so on. But silver vine has about the same level of efficacy. About 70% of cats respond to that, but it's not always, you know, the ones that don't respond to catnip may respond to that. So don't give up if you've got a cat. There are other herbal products that are very safe that you can use that may give your cat a little fun time.
And it's not bad for the
kids. It isn't bad for them. They actually, after they respond, they go through this, what we call a refractory period, where no matter how much catnip you put in front of them, they just can't respond. But then later on, they'll get exposed and they can do it again. And I swear, though, I had a cat that knew when I would be going to one of the like natural food stores and I'd buy the really fresh stuff, he would know when I came home with that. He could smell it through the bags, in the grocery bag. I had to keep it in a tin, in a cabinet, because he would get cabinets open and just, I would find it just ripped apart and shred. And obviously he had rolled in it and just loved it. So I think he truly was kind of a catnip addict.
Oh, man. Well, I tell you what, we'll turn from catnip to other topics, although we could come back to it if you have a question or comment about catnip or anything else for that matter in the pet health area. Give a call at 800-642-1234. And let's see. Let's go to Chris in Madison first. Chris, hi. Thanks for calling. Chris, are you there? Oh, I lost Chris. Let's try Mona in Madison. Hi, Mona.
Hi, Larry. Thanks. I have another question about cat eyes, about the color change in the pupil. Our cat's eyes are golden, and we noticed that her pupil was turning brownish around the bottom and up the sides, one of them, and there was no other symptoms. So we took her in pre-ophthalmology department at the university, and they scared us because they said, well, it's either benign and like a freckle, it's malignant, and the only way they could tell would be to take the eye out.
Yeah.
And she opted for watching, and she's had several good checkups.
Well, that's...
I'm thinking it's the freckle thing, but can you explain what the odds are of having one or the other of that?
Yeah. I don't know exactly what the odds are, but I'll explain what's going on. And I think rather than talking about, I think you were talking about the iris, the colored part of your cat's eye rather than the pupil.
Yeah. Right,
and
the iris.
There's a fairly common problem that we see in cats as they get older that's called iris melanosis, which is just they get pigment being deposited either as little freckles, or sometimes it can be actually covering a much larger area, but it's a benign process where the cat has totally normal vision, it's not affecting the pupil, and it's just like very smooth edges, and so you can, you know, you look at this and you go, yeah, that looks fairly benign. But there's another condition that cats can get that's called iris melanoma, which is a malignant tumor, just like when we get melanoma, that is considered a cancerous type of tumor. This happens in the cat's eye, and thank goodness it's in the eye, because when it's confined to the eye like that, it tends to metastasize very, very slowly. And so that's why ophthalmologists say, let's just watch and see what happens, because by far the most common thing is the benign process, iris melanosis, rather than the cancer, the melanoma. And the ophthalmologists, I have to say, they're right, because they're probably going to be listening to the show knowing that I'm talking about eyes. They typically say, let's watch and wait. And way back in the past, I mean, we used to take Polaroid pictures of cat's eyes and keep them in their record. Now we either do a digital picture and have it in the record, or owners keep tabs of it. And I just say every month, take a picture with your cell phone, you know, just up close of your cat's eye, and compare it to the month before and see, is it spreading? If you start seeing it spreading, then that's time to say, let's get them in and have it looked at, because the only way you can truly get a diagnosis is taking the eye out and having a look. And we don't want to do that if it's a benign process. So that's why we just watch. And that's very good of you to bring this up, because that's one of the things that we like to watch for is color change in the eye. And although that isn't really truly an emergency, it happens slowly, it is still something that you'd want to bring up with your veterinarian when you're in for your annual physicals.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today. We'll go back to our phones and take some more calls. And I believe Karen in Eau Claire is up next. So let's go to Karen. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I have a small dog that I treat like a cat. And she is prone to upper respiratory problems. And of course, it's winter in Wisconsin. And I'm wondering, I suspect, you know, what if She has some bronchitis going on.
So what are her symptoms?
What's her treatment aside from the obvious, you know, some antibiotics and maybe some vaporizer, or moist air, but...
Really, what are her symptoms? When you say upper respiratory, to me that usually means the nose and the sinuses.
Yeah.
Versus... the airway disease, which would be what, like you're talking about, bronchitis. So does your dog have nasal discharge? Are they coughing?
Yep.
Okay, so we've got both things going on. What breed of dog is your dog?
Yeah, it's a Brussels Griffon Terrier. She's got the smashed in face.
Okay. Well, that just anatomically can predispose them to more snorting, having, you know, just they can't clear their nasal normal discharge in their nose as well. Mm-hmm. And also being a small breed dog, they are more prone to having issues with things like collapsing trachea, where their airway is, instead of being a nice rigid a breathing tube, it's softer. And so if they get excited, it can start closing down and they start coughing with that. I also get concerned when we have small breed dogs, sometimes things like dental disease can, just to give you an example, I had a Cavalier in the other day that was started doing some reverse sneezing, which is more of what we call a pharyngeal cough, where they're kind of gagging and so on. And it turned out that the dog had an abscessed tooth that the owner didn't even know that it was an issue, but it had blown into the nasal passage. And so infection was in the nasal cavity from the mouth. So if your dog has dental disease, definitely get that looked into. That can result in tonsillitis, excessive saliva and bacteria that the dog may be inhaling and can cause some troubles as well. And also, small breed dogs are more prone to heart disease. And so having them when they go in for their physical, which as they get older should probably be twice a year rather than once a year, having the heart checked out to make sure they're not coughing secondary to heart disease with pressure on the airways because the heart's getting bigger. So there's lots of different things that can be causing this. And so to tell you, you know, use a humidifier or put them on antibiotics, I really can't without a thorough exam to find out what is actually causing your dog to have its problem.
Yeah. There we go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call, Karen. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Mary Ann up next from Hurdle. Hi, Mary Ann.
Hi. I have actually two dogs, one who developed a seizure disorder late in life. She has one bulging eye, and I thought maybe there might be a brain tumor or something going on, but then now I have another one that has a seizure disorder. They're both being medicated with phenobarbital. Both have chronic ear infections that it's just almost impossible to get them cleared up completely. And, you know, they're both in the same environment in the backyard. One's about 12 and a half, and the other's about 10 and a half. They are genetically related to each other as well. These are French bulldogs.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering, I'm kind of at my wit's end here.
Well, seizures are pretty scary to witness and even to have to deal with, too, because the medications that we use, you have to monitor them really closely because things like phenobarbital, although generally it's very safe, you have to be careful with the liver and making sure that you're dosing them correctly. And so it does take a lot of monitoring. What I get concerned about is even though they're related, they're also older dogs. And we do see just epilepsy in dogs. It usually starts when they're younger, usually a couple of years of age. It can be genetic in certain breeds of dogs, like the Beagle we see genetic epilepsy in, and poodles and so on. But when it starts as an older dog, we do get more concerned about things that are either involving the brain, like a brain tumor, an infection, something outside the brain like liver disease and having some liver toxicity issues that's affecting the brain. So there's other either metabolic things or things that are primarily affecting the brain like a brain tumor that would need to be investigated. What I would recommend is if you are concerned and you want to make sure that there's nothing that's being missed, setting up an appointment with our neurology service at the veterinary school. What they would likely do is they'd want to probably see your seizure diary. Hopefully you're keeping something so that we kind of know how often they're seizuring, how long they last, maybe things that happened before the seizure that may have been stressful that could be triggers, the current lab work and things like that from your veterinarian. They would do a full neurologic exam to start looking for is there peripheral nerves being affected? Is the dog's mentation, ability to swallow, see, all those things? So they do a full head-to-toe neurologic exam and then can get into doing some other imaging, such as getting an MRI of the brain to be able to look for things like a brain tumor. It's not necessarily a death sentence for dogs now. Our oncology department deals with dogs with brain tumors and are able to, with our tomotherapy, radiation therapy that's very directed. Our neurologists also do surgery on some dogs that have superficial tumors that they can get in and be able to safely deal with. So there are options for treating your dog. And it may even come down to perhaps phenobarbital isn't the best medication for your dog, and they may need to go on something else like Keppra or potassium bromide. So there's lots of other things that potentially can be used either separately from the phenobarb or in addition to the phenobarbital to be able to give your dogs better quality of life.
Oh, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Renee in Rice Lake is our next caller. Hi, Renee.
Hi there. I've got a question about, I've got two cats. I have an older 9-year-old cat that's been here in our house. And then a couple of months ago, we got a barn kitten, which brought with it all sorts of issues with the eyes. I'm assuming it must be probably cat herpes, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not knowing, obviously. We did keep them separated for about 2 weeks just upon bringing her into the home. And then she did develop this conjunctivitis, that type of thing, and then ultimately our 9-year-old cat did as well. And so we did have both of them treated first with like a salve in both of their eyes, and that didn't seem to cut it for the older one. And then we did go to an oral antibiotic for both of them. And while the younger one, it seems to be under control, hasn't had any issues since. The 9-year-old cat, I think we've treated it on two different rounds now with the oral antibiotic. And I'm just wondering, is this something now that has been introduced to her and she's just going to be suffering from for the rest of her life? She just has just that continuous conjunctivitis coming out of the eyes, that type of thing.
Yeah, this is a really good question because it's hard to say. Most cats get exposed to herpes when they're kittens. And sometimes it's a one and done. Other times it will, anytime that they're stressed, it'll come back to haunt them. It's very similar to herpes in people. Like you imagine like cold sores or canker sores where, you're stressed or in the middle of exams or whatever, and you break out with a canker sore in your mouth. The same thing happens with kitties. And so is your older cat stressed because of the new cat being in the household and just has a recrudescence of a prior herpes infection? Or was your cat truly not in the past affected by it and got a new infection, and now you're trying to deal with keeping it under control and the fact that the cat may be chronically stressed because, hey, I've been living my life by myself and now I have a new cat in the household? That may be part of it. One of the things that you may want to consider trying, if your veterinarian has ruled out other like bacterial infections, that there isn't anything else that could be causing this, that it's probably a viral conjunctivitis. There's an amino acid supplement that is available over-the-counter that is called lysine. And that might be something that you would want to try just using as a supplement. They come in chews and in paste and powder. You can get them online without a prescription. In fact, one of the companies that we carry in our pharmacy, it's actually lysine spelt backwards. Enacil is the name of the product that we'll sometimes use. But even with that, there are times where we have to use sometimes topical antiviral agents if we've got a really severe case of conjunctivitis or keratitis, which is inflammation of the cornea and the surface of the eye. We sometimes have to resort to using some of these other more heavy-duty drugs. But I'd talk to your veterinarian and see, would lysine be something to try? And, have they done anything else like corneal swabs to be able to see if they're, if they've got any other organisms there that they may need to be dealt with separately?
What would be the lasting impact of this? I mean, is it something that would eventually cause blindness or...
Usually conjunctivitis will not, although herpes can be pretty severe in cats and can affect the cornea, and we can see some corneal damage, and which then definitely can affect vision. And so we can sometimes see really severe ocular disease secondary to herpes, but those are usually few and far between. It's the typical cases. I get a little conjunctivitis, I do a little sneezing, I get over it. And many of them don't even need to be treated. It's just one of those things, you ride it out and they're done. Sometimes they will get secondary bacterial infections that need to be treated. And other times we need to start, like I said, going with antiviral drugs to be able to get them feeling better faster.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling, Renee. Appreciate your call very much. Dave in Cambridge has a question. Hi, Dave.
How you doing? Let me take you off. I have a cat that we got from the Humane Society about 8 months ago, and she was considered an adult, but she was probably only 8 months old at the time. And anyway, she wants to play 90% of the day, but she's like winking at us on a regular basis, and that it goes away, it comes back. There's absolutely no discharge. I've looked at the eyes to see if there's any cuts or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but in a goal, she'll do it one eye one day, and the next eye the other day. But it's like she's like, it would look like it hurts or something like that, or not hurts because she doesn't even act different, but. Like she's winking.
Okay. Is she holding it closed, or is it just like she's just kind of blinking her eye on that side more
rapidly
than the other eye?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like she's blinking her eye. She doesn't keep it closed. And she keeps, eye contact for, 30 seconds. We'll be, preying on each other.
Uh-huh.
And she will, keep eye contact, but that one eye, it's almost like a twitch,
Yeah. I mean, it could be anything from, carpet fibers, house dust, anything like that that could be a little irritating to her eye. But the fact that she's not rubbing it, it's not red, there isn't any discharge, it's probably nothing. Again, I'd be watching for all those things. I'd also be making sure that there's nothing else going on with her neurologically. Like, is the rest of her face twitching as well? Sometimes if we have issues with the cranial nerves, we'll start seeing kind of unilateral twitching and involuntary movements and things if we've got some nerve irritation. But again, it doesn't sound like that because it sounds like she's a healthy, happy, normal cat. I don't know why she's doing it. I would, if you can, if it sounds like it's, you've got enough time that when she's doing it, get your phone and take a video of it so your veterinarian can actually see what she's doing. And that might help with getting down to the, the nitty gritty as to what's causing your cat to do this kind of winking. I think it sounds pretty cute that she just sits there and looks at you and is like, hey, big boy,
And I like the video idea because you go to the vet, the cat will
never do it. I know. And we like videos too. Yep.
Thanks, Dave. Good luck. Appreciate the call. On to Dan in Wausau next. Hi, Dan. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have an 11-month-old terrier mix. We adopted him when he was about 10 weeks old. And every morning, I heard you talking about eye boogies before in the beginning of the show, and every morning we're cleaning out of both eyes, like white, almost a hint of green or yellow eye boogies.
Okay.
They're fairly big in both eyes, and they come back fairly quickly in the morning, and then throughout the day we're constantly cleaning them.
Well, you know, it's fairly normal to have those morning kind of the morning eye goo, and it's classically kind of a small amount of whitish material that, if it's been allowed to dry or be exposed to air, may kind of turn a rusty brown color. But the fact that you're seeing it throughout the day and that it's yellow or has a yellow or green tint to it sounds like we're dealing with a bacterial infection, and your dog may have some conjunctivitis going on, and that may need to be treated. It doesn't sound like it's an emergency that you need to see your veterinarian today regarding something like that, but it would be something that I think for your dog's comfort and for your comfort, just the fact that you're having to keep the dog's face clean from all this eye discharge, it would be something that I would bring up. And I'm glad that you are keeping the eyes clean. We'll see dogs that have even normal eye discharge, that little, you know, because they've got a little bit of hair that may be on their face, especially dogs with a hairy face where hair may be rubbing on their eye, causing a little bit of irritation. They get that little bit of morning goo building up in the hair, and the owners just let it build up. And now we've got this stuff stuck there. It's irritating to the skin, and that creates a whole different problem. Now we're dealing with a dermatitis around the eye, and that can be painful for the dog and more difficult to treat as well. So keeping the discharge cleaned away is helpful, but don't clean it right before you go to the vet, because then there's nothing for us to see. And sometimes we like to be able to see what the color of the discharge is. And so if your dog does wake up one morning and you've got an appointment, don't clean it and just say, you know, normally I do clean it every day, but I left it for you to be able to see. And that makes sometimes our job a little bit easier to be able to get a diagnosis.
There we go. Good. Okay. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And on to Heidi in Madison next. Heidi, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question regarding, it's kind of a behavioral question. I'm bringing a 3-year-old Moyen poodle. That's a poodle that's not a standard poodle, not a miniature, the in between, into my house. And the dog is used to kids and cats and other dogs. But I have a cat who's 10, and she's a female also, and she's not used to any of that.
Oh, boy.
So she, and she's a 100% indoor cat, and she does have claws.
Yeah.
And I was talking about that claw in my eyeball.
Yeah, that's very, I mean, that was one of those rare type things that
right.
We don't see every day. But this happens frequently to people where they have to introduce two different species. My best advice is let your cat be the one to introduce herself to your dog rather than the other way around. Okay, a lot of people like to pick the cat up and say, let's go meet the dog. And that can be pretty scary for them. So I like to have the cat have a dog-free zone. So baby gates, something like that set up where your kitty has easy access to the litter box or boxes, can get to their food, but maybe can just start watching the dog through the gate, and they know that the dog can't get them, can't chase them. Make sure that when you do start introducing them, that the dog is on a leash so that the dog is sitting there getting treats, not paying attention to the cat. So once the cat starts showing some interest, like maybe sitting at the gate and going, well, there's a dog there, maybe I'll come upstairs or, you know, come into the room, that the dog can't chase the cat. And providing the cat with elevated areas that are, again, places that the dog can't get to. So elevated cat trees, resting shelves, areas like that, that they can sit and watch the dog from a safe distance and be able to get away without being trapped in a room with the dog, and they can't get to the litter box or their food bowl. So it does take time, but most cats do adjust, especially if the dog starts learning that you don't chase the cat. That, you know, if you see the cat, turn to mom and dad because they've got good treats, or they'll play with a toy with you rather than the cat being this fun thing to be able to chase.
There you go. Good luck. Thanks very much for calling. And I had a Facebook question from Stacy says she read about a woman who unknowingly made her cat sick by adding eucalyptus oil to a room humidifier, and a lot of humidifiers are running these days.
Yep.
Can you suggest safe ways to use room diffusers when you have pets?
Well, this is a real interesting topic because we've been seeing more and more of these issues, especially with cats. Cats don't have the enzymes in their liver to break down some of the chemicals that are in these oils that you may use. And the oils that have been found to be toxic to cats besides eucalyptus are things like pennyroyal, clove oil, tea tree, peppermint, pine oils, you know, wintergreen, citrus oils, all, you know, a lot of the things that people like to use in their house or use in their own, you know, body products and things for themselves. And I think the issue comes down to what kind of diffuser is being used. There are two basic types of diffusers. There's one that's a passive diffuser, which maybe you've seen little reeds or something like that, where the oil's in a bottle and you put the reeds in and it just kind of evaporates on the reeds. And if the cat doesn't have contact with that, doesn't spill it, isn't rubbing up against it, it's probably not going to be an issue for them. But the ones that are called active diffusers, which actually make the oil into little micro droplets, I would assume that it's probably like it vibrates it to the point where it releases little micro droplets into the air, is a problem because those can land on the cat's hair coat or in the environment where the cat's going to be, and the cat grooms them off themselves and gets sick. And so I assume that's probably what happened to this cat.
Yeah.
So if you are going to be using essential oils in the house, make sure that you're using a passive diffuser and that it's out of reach of the cat, and that if the cat is in contact with these, that you get them bathed and seek emergency help right away, because symptoms can be death. Yes, that's probably the worst, but liver failure, drooling, sometimes they'll tremor, they may vomit, we'll see low heart rate, low respiratory rate. They can be very, very critically ill with exposures. So again, it comes down to if you want a cat, you may have to adjust the way you live in your house and not have things like that available.
Susie in Madison, we turn to you next. Hi, Susie.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Yes, I have a question. I have a tiny 6-pound dog with patellar luxation issues of both her hind legs. She's symptomatic in the right leg, but no longer symptomatic in the left. Now, I've had her see one veterinarian surgeon, and they recommended surgery of the right first and then probably the left one later on. But I took her for a second opinion, and the other surgeon recommended surgery on both legs at the same time. And I was wondering if you had an opinion about this, or is there any research that might support one approach over the other?
Oh, I don't know of any research. Sometimes I would think that it may come down to how severe the patellar luxation is, because we can see one leg worse than the other. We grade patellar luxations on a grade of from 1 to 4, where 1 is where it just slips out and goes right back in on its own, all the way to 4, where it's out all the time. And then you're looking at having to do some, pretty interesting surgery to get it back in and stay in. And so you're looking at a fairly lengthy surgical procedure. And for a little body, sometimes splitting them up may be better than trying to have them under anesthesia for an extended period of time. If the grading of the luxation is relatively minor and it's just a matter of doing maybe what we call lateral imbrication, where you tighten up the joint capsule on one side, or just, making the patellar groove a little bit deeper, where they go in and grind out the groove that kneecap should slide in. If that's the case, then they may be able to do both of them at the same time. So without knowing kind of how bad they are, I would have to say, trust your gut. How's your dog? And the surgeon, maybe the one that wants to do both of them, figures that, you know, one might be easy, one might be a little more difficult, and they could get them done in a timely manner and do it under one anesthesia. But usually I would be recommending probably doing one at a time.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, taking a look at your pet's health. Callers online, so let's go to the phones. And Mary in Exonia. Thank you for calling, Mary.
Hi. I had some of the outside cats came in this fall through the crawl space, and I'm worried that they gave something to my cat, to inside cats. I'm getting totally grossed out being stuck inside with them sneezing with a lot of phlegm, and I thought it would go away, but my daughter says that I should call you because she thinks it's the same thing that killed some of the barn cats outside, and I'm so glad that you talked about the oil stuff because I was going to try to have them inhale some tea tree oil vapor.
Oh, that would have been... No. That would be a big problem for your kitty. So, yeah, don't do that. Yeah, these outside cats that came in may have had some viral upper respiratory infections that have been transmitted to your cats. And then what we will see is, just like people that get the common cold will sometimes end up with a sinus infection. It's not that the cold virus is causing the infection, but bacteria have now been able to get in there with the damage that the virus did and set up housekeeping, and now you've got a bacterial infection. So many of these cats need to be on, even though it's initially caused by a virus, on an antibiotic if they're sneezing out green or yellowish nasal discharge. By all means, talk to your veterinarian about getting them on an appropriate antibiotic. What may help your cats to breathe a little bit easier, though, is to take them into a room like your bathroom where you have the shower running and you make it nice and humid. Sometimes that'll help loosen up some of the material in their nose and they'll be able to sneeze it out a little bit better. So humidity may be helpful, but just don't be adding anything to the humidifier that could be toxic to your pets, like eucalyptus oil or, you know, like you were saying, tea tree oil, anything like that could be a real big problem for them.
So they'd have to go to a vet.
Antibiotics are a prescription, and so as a veterinarian, I can't write a prescription for a patient that I don't have a patient-doctor owner relationship with, and even if it's been sometimes over a year since I've seen the pet, I'll have an owner call and say I need a new prescription for this medication, and I have to, unless it's a medication that is life-preserving, have to sometimes decline filling it because I don't have that patient-doctor owner relationship that's current. And we like to have that at least renewed once a year, similar to what you do with your doctor for getting maybe chronic medications that you may be on. So, yes, you do need to go to your veterinarian.
I was thinking of, as you were talking about the shower, Coco, one of the cats, loves to come in the bathroom when I'm having a shower and just sits there.
It may make them breathe a little bit better. They may just love that humidity, the warmth, who knows, but yeah.
He likes it, that's for sure. Stephen Hayward, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got an 8-year-old Shih Tzu, had him in the vet, and he's got a cataract in one eye. And I was just wondering, is there anything you can do for that? I know talking to people, sometimes their eyes are irritated when they have a cataract. Is there anything I can do for him for comfort?
Yeah, cataracts are where the lens, which is inside the eye on the other side of the pupil, become, instead of being crystal clear to allow light through, becomes more opaque, and it doesn't allow light to travel through. And so, obviously, if it was affecting both eyes, your dog would be having a hard time driving a car, crocheting, reading, that type of thing. And so we'd want to take care of it. One eye, the dog would probably be able to lead a pretty normal life if they have vision in the other eye. But when we have a dog with a cataract that is quiet. Again, I'd be just watching for changes in the eye, such as squinting, redness, any irritation that way, because as that lens matures, it can start breaking down, and we can get something called lens-induced uveitis, which is inflammation of the eye, which may need to be treated. And so some dogs with cataracts may have to be on drops to keep their eye more comfortable, but we wouldn't do that if the eye is normal and healthy but just has a cataract. You can also talk to your veterinarian about maybe being referred to an ophthalmologist to have the cataract removed if it is affecting the dog's vision in that one side. That is something that we do, just like they do in people. We do the same type of procedure in dogs as well. So that might be something to consider. We always want to make sure that there isn't any other medical problem going on. And although it would be uncommon to have a cataract only in one eye with something like diabetes, we do see dogs, usually middle-aged dogs, that develop diabetes. Sometimes the first symptom that the owner will see is that they develop cataracts. Even though they may have been drinking more and urinating more and hungry all the time and losing weight, the cataract may be the thing that brings them into the clinic to have that evaluated. And then we find out, oh, by the way, your dog's a diabetic, and that's what needs to be treated. So a good thorough physical, some blood work, making sure that there isn't any other underlying problems. And if the eye's quiet, we just let it be.
All right. There we go. Thank you so much, Steve, for calling. And on to Colette in River Falls. Hi, Colette.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, the question I have is a disagreement because between my husband and myself. We have an 11-year-old lovely golden retriever who weighs 100 pounds. He's a big boy. He took out, which in humans is the ACL, mm-hmm. on his knee. And he would like to have the surgery done. Now, the surgery is, because he's 11, is hard on a dog. It's about $3,500, and I have read that if he has a surgery done, he has a 40 to 60% chance of taking out his other knee, which would make it a $7,000 deal. Now, I would like to treat him with conservative treatment. I've been doing a lot of research, which is basically rest, chondroitin, and the other thing, and fish oil, and lots of rest. Possibly maybe some of those, there's some new braces that are out there running around $800.
Mm-hmm.
Because surgery itself is very stressful. We've taken his weight down to about 10 pounds and 90 pounds. And
okay.
And so I'm trying to say it doesn't make the investment in an 11-pound dog. We're trying to keep him comfortable and keep him healthy. And he wants to do the surgery. What do you think?
Well, it sounds like you need a marital counselor rather than a veterinarian. But no, these are all big things to consider. We have to look at the age of the dog. I'm going to give you an example. I had a dog in a week or two ago that I diagnosed a cranial cruciate rupture on. Similar, the dog was about 10 years old, golden retriever, normal weight though, so that was one thing. And as part of our workup prior to surgery, had chest x-rays done because we want to make sure that the dog is healthy. So we do some blood work, chest x-rays, and lo and behold, the dog has a mass in its chest that we didn't even know about. So the dog's been walking around with cancer, probably cancer. We're finding out today it's having an abdominal ultrasound done to find out what's going on with the rest of its body. But we ended up finding this. And so you always have to look at the dog, the big picture. So if your dog's blood work is normal, physical exam's normal, maybe chest x-rays are fine, and is a young 11-year-old golden retriever, then you may be able to give your dog 2 or 3, 4 years of being, you know, healthy and happy with the knee. Having surgery done isn't what causes the other one to rupture. It's just that if one ruptures, it's very common to have the other one because the same thing's going on both sides. Losing weight, a 90-pound golden retriever, even if he is a big boy, he probably still could lose some weight. So I'd really work on that. You know, those braces that you're talking about, I know that they're out there. There was just a good review article looking at the pros and cons of using them. And what they found is that most dogs don't find them very comfortable, that they wear, they rub, they can cause more irritation. And so if your dog is having a hard time getting around, surgery may be the thing to do. And again, I don't know what your finances are. Age isn't a disease, and so you may have a healthy, young 11-year-old dog, and your husband may be right. On the other hand, you may be right because your dog's an older dog and could have some other comorbidities that could be causing some troubles.
Lots to think about.
It is, yes.
And discuss.
And I am not going to get in the middle of it. Yeah.
There you go, Colette. Thank you very much for calling. And Barbara in Madison, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I've got a question regarding my cat. She's in her last late teens, and mm-hmm. she's very, very teeny. Her hyperthyroidism, the score is really, really high. And so a vet came and gave her, put her on nesimazole.
Mm-hmm.
And, excuse me, she was on it, and this is topically on the ear. She was on it for probably about 10 days to 2 weeks, and my cat always heard me when I'd come home, and she would, you know, run to greet me. Well, after about 10 days or 2 weeks, she was falling over as she was walking, trying to, you know, greet me at the door, and I immediately had somebody bring up the side effects of that drug, excuse me, and I didn't like what I found out about it. And
yeah.
So I immediately stopped. And she has a teeny cat, but she was giving her the standard dosage or whatever. I don't know. So I stopped that, and I do have a holistic vet, thank goodness now. But what I'm so we're trying all kinds of different things.
Yeah. We're kind of running out of time here.
Yeah,
so.
The big problems with methimazole typically is GI side effects, but then treating hyperthyroidism can unmask kidney disease. You get the decreases of blood flow through the kidneys, and so if you're older cat, that could be what was going on, is that we now have kidney disease on top of hyperthyroidism, something we always want to be watching for.
So you need to go back to the vet.
You need to go back and get some blood work done. It may not be the medication. It could be something else going on that the cat has just been masked with its hyperthyroidism.
And we'll be back right after the news. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, talking about your pet's health. And one thing, Sandy, that we always like to do right after our news break is to talk about your breed of the month. Last month we were, I think you highlighted that we might be talking about beagles.
I think beagles would be a good topic to bring up because, you know, they are the dog's dog. When you think of beagles, I mean, there's a reason why they use them in research and things, and it's because they're small and they're compact and they have the short hair coat and they're friendly and so on. But you know, as family pets, it was my first dog that I grew up with was a beagle, and boy, that dog had a nose and a half on it. And there's a reason why they like to be used for hunting. But you know, back when I got my dog when I was very young, we just didn't know of the things that you should be looking into. But now that I've been a veterinarian, I think that if I was going to be getting a beagle, I would be definitely really checking out what the breeder has looked into regarding inherited diseases that these dogs may have. And, you know, probably the big things, and we've already mentioned this earlier in the show, one of them is epilepsy. They are a breed that we do see inherited genetic epilepsy in.
Hmm.
And so, you know, knowing the family's health history, going back a couple of generations would be very, very helpful for that. They are prone to hypothyroidism, where their thyroid gland doesn't produce enough hormone, and so it's not just that their nose is good and they're eating too much, which they love to do, but they may have an issue with having some hormonal things that need to be taken care of. One of the real surprising things is, even though they're a tiny dog, or not tiny, but small breed dog, kind of, you know, they're about, you know, 13, 15 inches high. They're not very big. They do get hip dysplasia. And it's about 16% of beagles have issues with their hips, causing them later in life arthritic problems. And so one of the things breeders should be screening for is having their breeding stock's hips checked, just like you would on a large breed dog. They are more prone to back problems. They get disc disease. And, you know, so there's a number of things that way. But when I was just going and reviewing, like, what are the health issues with beagles, I love the fact that even as a seasoned veterinarian, I think that's a good way to put it, I learned something about the breed that I didn't even know they had it as a disease, and now I'm going to be looking for it. There's a genetic problem that they have that's called MLS. It's named after the two doctors that discovered it about 30 years ago, and it's called Muscladin-Lucky syndrome. And it's these dogs can live with this, but they tend to have one toe on the outside of their back foot, maybe shorter. They almost walk like ballerinas up on their tippy toes. They have a fold in their ear cartilage. Their face is a little bit flatter. Their eyes are a little bit slantier. Their skin's a little bit tighter. They don't have much of a scruff, but they can usually live with this. But it does affect their mobility a little bit. But I've had dogs in that have had these funky, weird toes that are one toe shorter, never touches the ground. And I'm going to start looking into this. And there's a genetic test that you can do now to be able to look into this. And this would be something that if I was consulting with a beagle breeder, I'd say you probably should be having this MLS test done. It runs about $50. It's done through UC Davis because it's probably pretty prevalent in the breed when we start looking for it.
Oh, my goodness me. There's always something,
always
isn't
something.
There?
Yep.
Well, we have many callers online. Cheryl in Conover has been waiting a bit, so let's go there. Cheryl, thanks for waiting.
Hi, how are you? Hi, Dr. Sandy.
Hi.
Hi, I just have to ask you about immune-mediated hemolytic anemia. If you had a dog that was 8 years old with an HCT of 14.8, an HGB of 5.6, and an RBC of 2.03, and a PLT of 77, what would your diagnosis be?
Well, the dog's obviously anemic, and then the platelet count is low as well. And so I'm not sure why the platelet count would be low, but the dog is very anemic. And it's a matter of ruling out diseases like tick-borne diseases before you start getting into immune-mediated diseases. But very well, with having that low of a red blood cell count of 14%, PEX cell volume, most dogs, if you take their blood and spin it down, you're going to find that they're at least 40% of the blood is going to be made up of red blood cells or more. And when it's down to 14%, that's really low. And the dog is in critical condition and needs to be treated. Immune-mediated diseases are treatable diseases. They're not fun diseases to treat. You have to use immunosuppressive drugs. You have to be, and they're often on them for months. Most dogs do go into remission. And then we just are very careful with not doing anything that could potentially trigger it again, like vaccinating them. Often we won't vaccinate, we'll do titers instead of vaccinating. So we're really careful about things that potentially could be triggering it, but it is something that can be treated.
Yeah.
Well, we had on Monday, January 15th, we had taken our rescue Molly Golly, who's a lab golden mixture. And she had these numbers, and our vet looked at us and said, you need to put her in the car and take her to Madison. And we looked at each other, and he felt that she would be dead in about 48 hours if we did nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we opted to send her to the Rainbow, because this is the second dog now that I've had with that. She had no immunizations recently. She had nothing. She was with our grandkids all weekend having fun. She showed no signs until it just, all of a sudden, she just stopped, laid down, and was sick.
Yeah. And I mean, it could be something other than immune-mediated disease. Sometimes things like, we do see a type of cancer called hemangiosarcoma, which is tumors of blood vessels, and they like to affect the spleen. And sometimes dogs will present with blood work similar to that, where the spleen has ruptured, they've bled into their abdomen, they come in acutely anemic. So that potentially could have been what was going on. So without, knowing what the head-to-toe physical showed us, there's a number of things it could have been, but and if it was immune-mediated disease, it is something that could have been treated, and even as a veterinarian, I mean, most veterinarians are going to have things like prednisone in their pharmacy. That would be something that would have been an inexpensive drug that could have been a good patch to get them through till they can get down and maybe have some other drugs that could help suppress the immune system administered. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, very sorry.
We went through it with a golden retriever and 2-3 transfusions before, who was 8 years old. Kept the dog alive till my son got home from college years ago, and I just didn't know if I wanted to put this animal through that because it was pretty ugly, and I see this happening more often now, and it's kind of traumatic, especially for an owner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, again, when we have, serious medical conditions like this, this is why I have pet insurance on 2 of my 3 dogs. Why? I'm a veterinarian, yes, but I don't do surgery. And if my dog had a serious illness like this that I wanted to have treated, I would not be in an emotional state to be able to do the treatment myself and would want one of my colleagues to do the treatment. And thus, I would have to
pay
them. So I have pet insurance. The only reason why I don't have it on the older dog is I got him when he was older, and as a result, he'd had too many pre-existing conditions, and it would have been more expensive than I would have wanted to pay. But for the younger ones, it's been definitely well worth it.
Yeah.
So think about that in the future. I am so sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Cheryl. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Michael on Facebook says his recommended Hill's TD prescription dental food was recommended by a vet. His cats and dogs love it, but worried about ingredients, especially corn and cellulose. Is dental food a good exclusive diet, or should it be used as part of a diet? As treats or not at all?
The dental diets that are out there, he's specifically talking about TD, which is one of the science diet or Hill's therapeutic diets. One of the things that's kind of my pet peeve is people that look at ingredients in food when we really should be looking at the food as the final product. And corn is not evil. Corn is one of those things that can provide fatty acids, vitamins, carbohydrates, and when it's cooked and included in the diet, it's part of the diet. And so you have to kind of get past that and not be looking at what is actually in the food. What I get kind of a laugh over is people saying, oh, I'm feeding my dog some weird protein, like I'm using a kangaroo-based diet because I want it to, have better protein source. Protein's protein, unless your pet has a food allergy. So, paying for exotic types of protein isn't going to make the diet necessarily any better. But back to the question about TD, it is an excellent diet. It is a very palatable, which is why your pets like it. It's well-balanced. They can stay on it for, unless they have some other health issue like kidney disease or liver disease or something like that, that they need to be on a different therapeutic diet. It is designed to be a full-fledged, eat-it-every-day type of diet. It has a fiber matrix in the middle, which is probably what the cellulose is used for, to create almost like a brush inside it. And so the tooth penetrates it, the food doesn't shatter, and it squeegees the soft plaque and things off the teeth before it can turn into tartar. And the dogs that I see that are fed these diets, dogs and cats, their mouth stays so much cleaner, especially if you're not able to get in there and brush daily like we recommend.
Elaine in Appleton, thank you so much for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, this is a comment. I've had dogs for over 50 years, and this is for people who have dogs that have cataracts or hard-of-hearing dogs. These dogs should not be allowed to go outside unless they're fenced in or tied up or you have them on a leash at night because they can't see and they can't hear.
Thank you for that. Yes, definitely. I just had a friend not too long ago actually lose her dog to a coyote. And it was an older dog that would go out in the backyard and just stay in the yard. And they had an electronic fence system. Obviously, that's not keeping wildlife out, too. So if you're living in areas where coyotes are a possibility, that would be another safety issue as well. It is. You have to really be careful with these dogs. I have an older dog with some dementia, and he sometimes goes outside and forgets how to get back in. And so we have to be there to be able to help him in. And you can imagine on some of those really cold days that we've had recently, what that would be like for him to be stuck out there and not be able to remember where the doggy door is to be able to get in. So yes, we do have to sometimes be their eyes and ears and sometimes their brains to be able to help them out as they get older.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling. Barbara in Cottage Grove, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a 5-year-old neutered male pug that has been absolutely healthy all his life. He does suffer from some high anxiety in certain situations, but all of a sudden, in October of 17, he started marking in the house. And I took him to the vet, and I couldn't get a urine test done, and we had to rule out UTI or an infection, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Took him to the vet. I couldn't get a urine specimen. He tried needling his bladder, could not get any urine. So he put him on antibiotics for 2 weeks, not prophylactically, but just to see if it would do anything. So he was on Clavamox. That was over. He continued to mark. I finally went in and had, the complete panel done. He had an x-ray, he had labs, he had to have a cystocytosis, he had to UA, culture, everything. Everything came back completely normal.
So it's behavioral, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
I'm at my wit's end.
Yeah.
With this dog.
Right. Well, the key word is he's a little anxious. And when dogs, especially neutered males, are marking, it's not sex related, trying to attract a girlfriend or keep other, boys away. But it can be anxiety related, and it's their way of making the whole house smell like them, and it makes them feel a little more comfortable. Similar to why male cats and female cats will urine mark as well. And so we always want to look at, is there something like a new dog in the neighborhood, something changed in the household that could be the trigger for this, a new person in the house, a new schedule, anything that could potentially be a trigger. We sometimes try these dogs on various anti-anxiety medications. I've had some dogs respond when it's very mild to just as something as simple as a dog appeasement pheromone collar. They're available over the counter. They're called DAP collars. But sometimes we do have to resort to using some kind of anti-anxiety medical management. I've even, in some male dogs where this is just a chronic problem, used things like a belly band. You can buy them online. If you just Google dog belly bands, it looks like a cummerbund type thing that a dog would wear that doesn't allow them to have any urine hit the surface. When they lift their leg, it just gets absorbed into the band rather than getting on your couch or whatever. Making sure that you're cleaning really well, that you're using enzymatic cleaning cleaners on everything. A couple of my favorites, anti-icky poo, AIP, and urine off would be the other two things. And making sure that you're going through maybe with a black light to see where he has urinated so you can treat all the affected areas so he's not going to be going back to those spots again. But it really comes down to what is the anxiety triggering event that brought this on. And sometimes we never find out and we just need to treat it as an anxiety-based problem. But your veterinarian did everything perfectly. I'd be doing exactly the same thing. Rule out medical things first, and then it comes down to a behavior problem.
Yep, there we go. Thank you, Barbara. Good luck. Appreciate your call. I want to give Gary in Soldiers Grove a chance. Gary, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hello. I have a year-and-a-half-old Shar Pei male, and his eyes are constantly watering. He's scratching at them. I think it's entropia.
Entropion, yes. Okay, and what that means, and this is like goes hand in hand with being a Shar Pei, is the eyelids of dogs sometimes instead of sitting and like ours do, just kind of run up and down on our eye, they curve in, they roll in. And so the hair, that eyelashes and the hair that's on the eyelids starts rubbing on the surface of the eye. Some of these dogs, it is such a serious problem for them that they have to have a little plastic surgery done to be able to roll those eyelids out so they can live a comfortable life. When Shar-Pei's are babies and they're growing into all their folds in their face, some ophthalmologists will put in a temporary tack as they're growing just to try to see if they'll outgrow this. But a year and a half old dog with that significant a problem needs to visit with a veterinarian that is comfortable with doing some eyelid surgery. The problem is you don't want to overdo it. If you take too much tissue away, then you do exactly the opposite. It's called ectropion, where now you've turned your Shar-Pei into a basset hound or a bloodhound with those droopy eyelids, and now you've got big pockets for all that stuff in the environment to accumulate, and now they've got irritated eyes for a totally different reason because their eyelids don't fit properly and they're loose and not running on the eye the appropriate way. So, yeah, you want to deal with somebody that knows what they're doing. They're not going to leave too much, and they're not going to take away too much. They're going to do it just right.
Thank you very much for calling. Carol emailed to say she recently lost her English bulldog, and she's in the process of starting to look for a new puppy. Losing her dog was very painful. She wants to be sure she gets a healthy puppy. What should she be looking for when she's evaluating whether a puppy is healthy?
Oh, this is a really good issue because bulldog puppies are notorious for having lots and lots and lots of health problems. And so working with a breeder that is evaluating for urinary stones, making sure that they are checking hips and knees, that they're, you've got mom and dad there that you can evaluate, that you can maybe go back two or three generations if possible and be able to see what kind of problems those dogs may have died from or had. Bulldogs are very special needs dogs that I would make sure that you're working with a breeder that has a very simple guarantee, lifetime, that if there is a problem, they are there to back you up to be able to either get you another puppy or help with the problem that may be diagnosed in the puppy. So getting that type of guarantee, and although it sounds very simplistic, that's what I would be looking for if I was in the market for another dog.
And let's turn, Tracy, do you have a quick question? Hi, Tracy.
Just really quick. I have a six-month-old kitten who I've only had him about a month. I've had him to the vet three times now because of eye discharge. He's got a kind of a white face, and his discharge is kind of chunky and dark. And he's been sneezing. Probably I hear maybe 4 to 6 times a day sneezing.
So probably some type of chronic upper respiratory problem that he picked up when he was a kitten. Again, trying the lysine, that may be helpful. The normal tears in a white-faced cat will turn that rusty brown color. And so daily keeping the face clean, some breeds of cats like the Persian cats, it's very common for them to have tearing on their face just because of the way their face is built. And so it may be confirmational as well. But this would be something that if you want to get to the bottom of it, if your veterinarian can't find anything wrong, get a visit with an ophthalmologist. It may be that he's got plugged tear ducts or has something else that's going on that may be able to be treated, and then he can live a healthy, normal life without eye goo.
Yeah, which would be very nice.
Wouldn't that be nice? Yes.
Thank you very much, Tracy, for calling. Appreciate your call. And Sandy, always a pleasure.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, you're going to be back on February 27th.
Right at the end of the month, yeah.
With another breed of the month.
Oh, we'll see. I don't know at this point yet, but we'll try to figure out one, yeah.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine will be back with us on February 27th. Tomorrow at 11 o'clock, we'll be talking about family cabins. And maybe you've got a family cabin you want to talk about. I hope you do. At 11:45, we'll take a look at gardening in the north, gardening in northern Wisconsin. In the meantime, Thanks for listening. Please stay with us.